Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 26, 2026, we're delighted to host a discussion on safeguarding vulnerable populations online. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Director of Networks here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, with four panelists, much to discuss and only an hour to do it, we will keep our introductions today incredibly brief. Name and title, not much more. So if you are interested in learning more, I would highly recommend you check out our speakers' impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and then I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Professor Paul Cassell, who is the Ronald N. Boyce Presidential Professor of Criminal Law and University Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Utah College of Law, where he teaches criminal procedure, crime victims' rights, criminal law, and related classes. And I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens. If you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Professor Cassell, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, and welcome to our webinar on safeguarding vulnerable populations on the internet. Of course, the internet is ubiquitous in modern life, but along with that ubiquity has come threats to vulnerable populations, such as children and the elderly. Today's panelists will explore various responses that have been undertaken to those vulnerabilities. For example, the federal government has been able to pass some legislation in this area. I think all would agree there's been mixed success in that area, leaving the states to consider whether they should step in to adopt legislation or other efforts on their own. Today, we've got four panelists who are very experienced in this effort, and I'll just introduce them very briefly and then ask them to start providing some thoughts on this important area. We have Spence Purnell, who's a resident senior fellow on technology and innovation at the R Street Institute, Claire Morell, who's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Brandon Smith, who's a partner at Holtzman Vogel and is co-leading their state AG practice, and India McKinney is the Director of Federal Affairs for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I want to begin by asking each of our four panelists to talk about their perspectives on current enforcement efforts. What are they seeing as important efforts to protect vulnerable populations on the internet? And I think Spence is going to lead us off.
Sure. Thanks for that introduction. And yeah, let's just dive right into it. So as we said, we've got a lot of panelists, so I won't take up too much time, but I figured I'd want to maybe set the conversation up by talking about sort of the elephant in the room in terms of federal legislation, which is the Kids Online Safety Act, COSA. And I thought maybe I could outline some of my practical concerns with some of the federal and state pieces of legislation. And then maybe second, I'll discuss some of the constitutional and legal concerns I have with them. I think, first of all, what I really wanted to discuss was the Kids Online Safety Act and the practical age verification that it's going to require. And it's convenient for me to have this discussion today because I don't know how many of you are aware, but Discord, a popular digital chat service, last week announced that they were going to do universal age verification, and they announced some partners, maybe not universal is the right description, but more or less universal. And they announced some third-party partners that they were going to use to store and process data. And it was uncovered that there were some privacy and security issues there. And there was a huge negative backlash to the whole situation online. So I bring that up is to say that is one of my primary concerns with the Kids Online Safety Act and with overall the idea that we have to age verify the internet to protect children. It inculcates many more people than just the children, and it presents a huge privacy risk to us all. The next piece of legislation that I thought I'd bring up is already passed, is the Take It Down Act. And there's a separate practical concern there, and it'll relate to sort of the Section 230 conversation we'll have later. But there's really a litigious concern that I have there, that as we continue to create these carve-outs to Section 230, that they open the door to constant litigation that only the big technology firms will be really able to absorb, and it will have a serious negative impact on small and medium sized enterprises. I guess the other thing I wanted to discuss was the duty of care that's in COSA, and just say that I think that practically, the problem with duty of care is that when we're defining the categories of harm, it can become a very much a gray area. So we create a situation where regulators and legislators are ultimately the ones who will decide what is harmful. And that kind of, brings us into a questionable situation constitutionally, where the government is determining what content is or isn't okay for kids, like content about diets or body figure, things like that, things that are very personal. And so jumping into some of the cases, I think a lot of that questions that I just talked about are being discussed in these cases, and that's maybe where ultimately some of this will get decided. But I think from more of a constitutional perspective, when you're talking about age verification, rather than it being a practical privacy concern, it's much more of a First Amendment concern, and people being able to speak anonymously online and to not have to submit a potentially vulnerable digital verification to exercise their right to free speech. And then in the cases against Twitter and some of the online platforms for more or less design features, things like infinite scroll algorithms, things like that, and whether that protects them under Section 230. I also think that there are serious First Amendment concerns and problems with how the government will get involved to enforce those things. And so that could infringe upon the First Amendment rights of designers and developers and things of that nature. So again, we have a lot of panelists, but those are just, the practical problems with age verification, the practical problems with carving up Section 230, and the practical implementation problems of a duty of care. And that's not even to speak about the First Amendment or constitutional or statutory issues that some of those pieces of legislation or court cases may have. And I think we've seen a couple of enjoinments and injunctions and other things happen in some of the net choice cases that demonstrate those well. So I won't go into detail. But yeah, those are some major pieces of federal legislation and cases I'm looking at, and some of my concerns with them.
Thanks, Spence. I think Claire's going to go next now.
Yes, thank you. So I just want to give a little bit of more of an overview of what's happening at the state level, and just kind of what types of laws are we discussing. And so just to kind of set the framework a little bit more, states have gotten very involved in the last several years in trying to pass laws to protect kids online. And I think largely, which I know we'll get into next, because of Section 230, parents and children, their children who have been victimized by social media platforms or online pornography websites, have had trouble actually getting justice and being able to kind of pursue their cases in court. And so I think in response, we've seen a lot of state legislatures step up to say, okay, are there more protections we can provide to parents that will give them a means of recourse for holding these companies accountable for harms to their children? And so I've been very involved with helping states pass age verification for pornography websites laws, which have now passed in 26 states. And the Texas law was upheld last summer by the Supreme Court in Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. And so I think that was a really critical ruling in upholding a lot of these state efforts. And the enforcement mechanisms in those laws vary from state AG enforcement to some just it's a private right of action, so that if a parent, if a child accesses basically a pornography website, then they're allowed to bring a case in court for the damages. And a lot of these laws then have a presumed kind of damage statute saying that they're entitled to a certain kind of fine amount for each instance a child accessed a pornography website. And then the other kind of category of laws that I have been tracking and involved in are parental consent laws for social media that would actually require these websites to verify the age of their users, and then if it's a minor, obtain parental consent. So 10 laws have passed so far. More are being introduced this legislative session, and they vary state to state, but largely they all kind of require some type of parental consent. The kind of outlier is the state of Florida passed an outright ban for minors under 14 and then parental consent for 14 and 15 year olds. And theirs actually doesn't require age verification on the front end. It creates an ongoing responsibility on the part of platforms to be determining accounts that are minors and then either obtaining parental consent or shutting them down. And it's kind of trying to, I think, make it an easier constitutional hurdle to overcome by saying these companies already collect all this data. They use these business analytics. They can tell the age of their users. So rather than requiring all users to go through some type of age verification to get onto the platform, there's just a responsibility on the part of the platform to be identifying and then removing or obtaining parental consent for accounts that they deem to be minors. Now, many of these laws, I'm sure some of my co-panelists will point out, have been enjoined on the social media front, but there have been some key cases in the Fifth Circuit. They upheld Mississippi's age verification and parental consent law. They lifted the injunction that was placed by a lower court on that law to allow it to go into effect. And then the same for Florida, which again took a little bit of a different approach. The 11th Circuit lifted the injunction on that law, allowing it to go into effect. So to my knowledge, I haven't seen a lot of enforcement mechanisms, you know, or actions brought yet by these states. These laws have so recently been allowed to go into effect, but that is something I'm actively tracking. And then I will also flag, with the rise of AI technologies, a lot of states are now also entertaining and introducing bills around age verifying and age restricting children's access to AI companion chatbots. So not all forms of artificial intelligence, but particularly these companions that have been shown to be engaging children in romantic and sexual conversations and relationships, and have had some initial lawsuits brought by parents against some of these companies just because of the harms to their children. And so I know about 6 or 7 states have already introduced so far some version of an AI companion chatbot bill. So those are kind of the three categories that I'm tracking. And I think just kind of to lay the groundwork again, I think the heart of these laws is to really try to empower parents and particularly allow them an avenue to bring a case in court if their children are harmed by these technologies, which has been largely closed off because of Section 230. And so I think just in the framing of this conversation today, thinking about how do we protect victims of these kind of online harms, these laws are a response, I think, directly to that. And yeah, hopefully we can get more into the arguments back and forth about these laws later on. But that's just my kind of ground level framework.
Thanks, Claire. Brandon, I think over to you.
Yeah, so just to frame the situation that we're seeing right now, modern digital platforms are central to how kids are engaging the world around them. It's essential to how they're socialized, how they're entertained. But these platforms were never designed with kids' safety as the primary objective or even as a goal. Unlike physical spaces, online platforms have a global reach that are leaving children susceptible to addictive design, harmful content, and predatory conduct. So that's the space in which we've seen a lot of state AGs engage. So state attorneys general have been at the forefront of this issue for a long time, as being the primary organizers of some of the Net Choice litigation to the Meta and Facebook investigations, the TikTok challenges. They've been the ones that have been sort of filling the gap in the lack of federal regulatory framework. And in filling that gap, what we've seen is a robust expansion of consumer protection laws at the state level being used to hold tech companies accountable for intentional design issues that create addictive or dangerous opportunities for kids. Relatedly to that, private litigation has sort of a complementary role in all of this. Families, school districts, parents have filed numerous lawsuits alleging that the features of certain platforms, greatly simplified feeds, algorithmic drives, notification engineering, parental parental control setups are exploiting the psychological vulnerabilities of the youth. These private suits have brought evidence of and facts to light to have informed public understanding, and have been pressuring platforms to innovate more safely going forward. Combined, this AG enforcement level and private litigation has created a real multi-pronged accountability ecosystem. Now, one of the key political legal risk issues, I think, with any of the federal laws that have been proposed and discussed is that federal preemption could insulate platforms broadly from accountability. And we should guard against statutory regulatory frameworks that inadvertently lock in the current status quo of vulnerabilities for kids by immunizing design choices from challenge, especially by state AGs or in private litigation. State efforts and private suits ensure a more competitive regulatory experimentation without a one-size-fits-all approach that allows the feds to put a thumb on the scale. But state AGs aren't attempting to ban platforms as much as they're demanding responsible operation and accountability when there is harm to address. And that harm is very real, specifically for kids. The U.S. Surgeon General report in 2023 reported that 95% of teens report that they use social media daily, with about a third saying they use it, quote, near constantly. Young girls who spend more than 3 hours per day on social media face double the risk of poor mental health outcomes, including depression, anxiety, and suicide. CDC data from 2021 saw that 57% of high school girls reported persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness, the highest level ever recorded. And maybe more disturbingly, emergency room visits for self-harm among adolescents rose nearly 60% between 2011 and 2018. The average age of first exposure to online pornography is now around 11 or 12 years old, with many reporting exposure even at a younger age. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children reports tens of millions of online exploitation reports annually, many involving direct contact with minors. So this risk that we're talking about isn't hypothetical. It's a measurable harm that's here now. And in my area of practice in law, both when I was in the government and now in private practice, watching that state AG traditional consumer protection enforcement as a response has been maybe one of the more interesting developments in this space in the last 10 years. I will stop there so that we can all tee up the Section 230 argument we're inevitably going to stumble into in a minute.
Yes, thanks, Brandon. We'll get to that in a second, but I think India has a chance now to provide her overview of the landscape out there.
Yes, thank you so much for that. So again, my name is India McKinney. I'm the Director of Federal Affairs at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so one thing I'd like to say at the top is when we're discussing this, I think it's really important that we separate minors' First Amendment rights for speech, for other content, and for pornography. We have traditionally held that pornography has a different set of rules around speech. But aside from that, minors actually do enjoy the same First Amendment rights to talk about politics, to create art, to comment on the news, to discuss or practice religion, and quite a whole lot more. And those are parts of the reasons why quite a lot of the state laws have been found to be unconstitutional, as they restrict minors' ability to access that type of content online. So that's an important thing to discuss first up. The second thing is there's a little bit of a tension here when we start talking about this, because a lot of the things that we're discussing are the lack of privacy rights for all internet users and what actually happens if you create a system where you have to verify somebody's age, which means you have to verify their identity. You're actually creating a greater privacy risk for everybody who uses that particular platform, as we literally saw with Discord. They already had a breach with some of this personally available information. And so now what these laws are doing is incentivizing platforms to collect even more personally identifiable information without any sort of safeguards that would protect all of the users from having their identity stolen or used or manipulated or whatever. Also, there are some problems, and EFF has worked on this for a long time, there are some real challenges in the current legal and legislative setup of identifying specific harms to an individual that came from a specific privacy breach. And that is a really huge thing that we have to tackle. And it's worth tackling for all users, not just for kids. So if Congress would stop focusing on just children as the only people that are worthy of protection, saying that seniors are not, saying that veterans are not, saying that military spouses are not, all of which are very specific instances that have had targeted attacks against them and their private and personal information being used to scam them. If we can focus on all users, we sidestep the whole issue of age verification or age gating or all of this stuff, which removes a giant hurdle, a giant risk. And so we can focus on creating a comprehensive privacy law with a private right of action and that does not preempt the states from going further. If we can do that, which is going to be hard, we tried it a couple of times. It ran into a lot of roadblocks. Data brokers got really involved in trying to weaken the law. It's hard. It's hard to do well. It's hard to do right. But the benefit of doing it is you can sidestep some First Amendment problems and you don't have to figure out who's a child because we all get to enjoy the same protections, which would be really great.
Well, thanks, India. And thanks all the panelists for that good overview. I think a few of our panelists have mentioned probably the most significant piece of federal legislation out there, which is known as Section 230, and in particular, the immunity it's created for certain civil suits. I'm actually working on a case where we have a cert petition pending right now. Several justices on the Supreme Court have called for review of the scope of Section 230 immunity. But let me just rotate through our panelists again to see if they've got thoughts on what they're seeing in that area and what they would like to see in that area. So I think, Spence, we'll send it back to you.
Yeah, so I don't, I would love to discuss Section 230 at a broader level in a deeper way. But I guess one thing I wanted to address specifically in this conversation is the distinction between design and content. And I would contend that you can't really disentangle the two. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. The first would be that the features themselves are kind of worthless without the content, right? Ari Cohn at Fire has been giving this example that I've been hearing a lot lately. If every post was a blank painting of watching paint dry, it wouldn't much matter how many likes or reposts or shares or infinite scrolls. You could name any kind of feature that you wanted and it wouldn't really be addictive. So the design of the platform and the content of the platform are deeply intertwined, right? And so I think That's a huge problem. And I think that's an argument that we've been hearing a lot is that it's not content, it's design. And that will move us from strict scrutiny to intermediate scrutiny. And I just think that really misses the point. And I think we have to be a lot more careful about the ways that we could affect content itself and therefore speech itself. As India was saying, it's, you know, even though they're teenagers outside of pornography, they do have First Amendment rights. And to Brandon's point, yes, there are very real measurable harms and those are tangible, but there are also very tangible benefits. And so we have to be very careful before we completely distinguish design from content and just say, well, there's harms and we have to address them. And I think you're only looking at one side of the conversation if you do that. And so I think Section 230 is going to remain super important. And I guess the second point I'll add on just to kick into that is, even with like the duty of care and COSA, I think that has the potential to be a Section 230 violation because it's essentially telling platforms, you know, what about like diet advice? You know, if some people are telling you to eat less or eat more, some people say that could cause body dysmorphia. And that's just one small example. But I think, you know, if you're of a certain persuasion, that could be conversations about LGBTQ. If you're of another persuasion, that could be about guns, Second Amendment, right? Other things like that. And so we have to think very carefully about whether we really want agencies like the FTC and Andrew Ferguson and Brendan Carr. These are realistically the type of people that are going to, you know, have an input in what content is ultimately allowed or denied.
Thanks, Spence. I think Claire, we'll hear from you next on this.
Yes. So I have a little bit of a different take from Spence, which I don't know. It probably won't be surprising to people given a lot of my writings on this. But so I actually do think it's a very important distinction to make. And I'm encouraged actually by recent lawsuits going forward. For a while, it felt like if Section 230 is going to change, it's going to have to be reformed by Congress. But I actually think we've seen recent cases going forward that are just distinguishing really the original intent and purpose of Section 230 and clarifying where it's been kind of overly expanded by the courts. And where these cases are succeeding is when they're focusing on the design elements of these social media platforms, because they're trying to explain that the liability that they're trying to hold the platforms accountable for is because of their design features, not harms from third-party content that those platforms were merely hosting. And so one of those recent decisions was the Third Circuit in TikTok v. Anderson that basically said that this mother's lawsuit could go forward because her 10-year-old daughter had died from a blackout challenge that was fed up to her on TikTok via her For You feed by their algorithm. And the court just distinguished that, you know, while the harm purportedly was from this other person's content that posted this blackout challenge, that her daughter would never have come across it. She didn't search for it if it hadn't been for that platform's recommendation algorithm that dumped it into her feed. And so they allowed, you know, her lawsuit to go forward for that particular design feature, that they should be held accountable then if there are harms that come then from their algorithms. And then now we're seeing these social media trials starting to progress. And so I know Brandon mentioned the state AGs. So there's a massive multi-district litigation of attorneys general bringing a case against a lot of these social media platforms, again, focused on the design features and using their kind of unfair and deceptive trade practices statutes to say these things were marketed as, you know, safe for kids and their designs have been addictive and very harmful to children and their mental health. I really appreciated all the statistics that Brandon shared, just making the case that this is a really serious and urgent situation that our youth are facing and that parents really do need help. And then the most recent trial is the one going on in Los Angeles, this bellwether trial brought by this plaintiff. And I've been following it very closely, and I'm hopeful that this will be, again, a way to kind of poke, I think, some critical holes in what's been a just massive shield of Section 230. That I think has been expanded beyond its original intent and meaning, just essentially immunizing these companies for even things that are their own wrongdoing, not just third-party content they're hosting, but their features like the design of like buttons, recommendation algorithms, infinite scroll, autoplay, all these features that they have intentionally designed that are their product design. And that is the argument that's being made. And so it's still to be determined what the jury will decide in this case. But I think the arguments are very compelling that the platforms knew and intentionally designed their design features to be addictive to minors and failed to warn consumers about those harms. So I'm hopeful that regardless of whether we see kind of any Section 230 reform go through Congress, that some of these recent lawsuits are providing some needed clarification for how that law should be applied.
Thanks, Claire. Brandon, your thoughts on.
Yeah, so I think there's a core legal baseline about Section 230, which is that it was intended to provide immunity for third-party content and editorial decisions about publishing that content. It was never intended to be a shield for actionable wrongdoing or tortious wrongdoing arising from the platform's own conduct. Just like we would still hold a newspaper liable for not what it prints on its editorial page, but for printing it with carcinogenic ink. That's the analogy I like to think of here. Section 230 doesn't protect platform design choices like addictive infinite scroll or engagement maximizing notifications or psychological manipulation built into the platform that would foreseeably, knowingly, or negligently harm users. It does not protect algorithmic recommendations where the platform's own actions are meaningfully contributing to user harm, like we've seen in TikTok. And negligent security practices are not protected. Those practices that expose minors and predators to grooming or exploitation. And I think that this is where the law is moving. This is where the law has been. And I think the law will continue to recognize this more. So the In Re Facebook case in Texas, like the show or held that Section 230 specifically doesn't immunize also the platform's own misconduct as it relates to misrepresentations made about the safety or usage. There's no sweeping but-for test for immunity. A platform is not immune simply because third-party user content is part of the factual backdrop that created the harm inflicted upon the plaintiffs or in the state AG cases on the citizenry. Immunity applies only when that liability would require treating the platform as a publisher of that content. That's the Salesforce case in the Fifth Circuit. And then as I think Claire started to get at too, you have the failure to warn and failure to disclose claims that are completely unaffected by Section 230 immunity and can and survive challenges on those grounds. But the big elephant in the room, not to reuse that analogy, is that the product design itself can be negligent. And I do think you can distinguish between content and design. And making that distinguishment is not just is not just how we would view First Amendment laws generally, but it's very like practical and realistic. Like the lawsuits that we're seeing going forward have nothing to do typically with the actual content, although there's harmful content in the background. Misrepresentations about the safety precautions taken on a particular platform when they're outright lies to the consumers, like constitute a consumer protection violation at the end of the day. But more than that, I think that there is obviously a lot of overlap to kind of get into one of the other First Amendment fights the Supreme Court did address on this front in the pornography landscape. So groups like EFF, for example, have tried to make that distinguishment. But like as Indy, I would love to hear you say like EFF is also radically opposed or like consistently rather opposed age verification laws for adult entertainment websites. And we're trying to draw a distinction, but in reality, that content does matter in that space. And yet EFF still opposes it in even those basic restrictions that the Supreme Court has upheld. I think where 230 is headed is that there will continue to be immunity for publishing like essentially conspiracy theory content or like bad medical advice from whatever Instagram health influencer is popular this week. But how you design the platform to function, especially when we know and have seen in what's come out over the last few years, how most of these platforms were specifically designed to become as addictive as possible for as young of a user base as possible, often in violation of pre-existing state and federal law, that Section 230 is not going to shield big tech from that and is not shielding big tech from that, which is why these cases are moving. So I hope I dropped a few grenades there for everyone to pick up. But I tried to call out India since she's next. But I know you'll have great thoughts on this too.
Yes, we will hear from India next. Let me just make a quick note, though, for our audience out there. There is a question feature. So if you want to start getting involved in our discussion here, that'd be a good time to do that. But India, over to you.
Yeah, let me pick some of those up and throw them back at you. The Ninth Circuit decision, I forget what year it was, but it's the roommates decision, which is one of the big ones about where Section 230's immunity, I think the term of art, the legal term of art. And again, I am not a litigator. I am a lobbyist. I am not a litigator. But the legal term of art is material contribution to the malicious design, the harmful design of platform. And so that is, that already exists. That's existing case law. And so we are definitely paying attention to see how some of these other things interact with that standard that's previously been set as we move forward. The other thing is, the one you picked up and I will throw back is, yeah, we did object to some of the age gating on some of the pornography websites because of the privacy violation. The First Amendment also creates a right to anonymous speech, which includes the right to anonymously receive content. And so as soon as you're having to prove your identity as you're going to a pornography website, you lose that First Amendment protection. And there are real harms that can come to adults from that. So there is no privacy protective way to
age verify to age gate to age, whatever you want to call it. There's a whole bunch of different words on that. And that actually does create a problem. The Supreme Court decided that that was not as much of a problem as protecting minors in their decision. But that is a thing that we are still concerned about. The ability to both comment anonymously and to receive content anonymously is something that we really want to make sure that we don't lose. The other thing that I want to make sure that we're separating when we talk about Section 230 is the difference between what Section 230 does and what the First Amendment protects. Kind of a lot of times when people start talking about what they don't like about Section 230 is what they actually don't like about the First Amendment. There is going to be content that exists that is legal, constitutional content that you do not like. You may not like that your children see it. That doesn't mean it's unconstitutional, and that doesn't mean that they don't have a right to see it. There's a huge difference between what the government is allowed to tell platforms to do and what you as a parent, you as an individual, we as a society think is okay. That's not the same question. And allowing the government to come in and decide what information the populace is allowed to receive is deeply, deeply concerning to us on a whole bunch of different levels, whether you're an adult, whether you're a child, anybody in between. And so those are things that I really want to make sure that we're separating as we move forward. And I totally agree that it's interesting what the courts are doing. There's a lot of novel things that are coming up on this. The courts are certainly taking a look at this carefully. We weigh in on a lot of these cases. We are active litigators. So I would encourage anybody who's interested in the specifics of our positions. We are amici in a lot of these state law cases at the federal cases. And so we have a pretty robust litigation page. We post all of our stuff to our website. So if you want to see more about what we actually think, I will not be able to summarize it in an hour, but I encourage you to go check that out.
Well, thanks. I think what I'm going to do now is to start inviting our panelists to engage with each other, but maybe a vehicle for that. And we're getting some interesting questions here. So let me throw out the question here, and then anybody who wants to jump in, go from there. Of course, I think a lot of people are following the big case in Los Angeles with the social media companies. Does anybody want to predict the verdict and then predict the ramifications from that verdict? So I'll throw that out to our panelists here and see if anyone wants to take that one.
Yeah, I guess I'll do it since I'm the lawyer on the panel. You never know what's going to happen in trial. So with the caveat of you can't predict anything with any level of certainty, I think that the plaintiffs have a great shot at winning here. And I think it is likely we're going to see big tech be held accountable, especially on the platform design and misrepresentation side of it. It is insane to me to think that you can design a product, even if it's a software product, knowingly that it's psychologically damaging, knowing that it's destroying the lives of your user base, and have zero liability for that. And no one can do anything about it because you're publishing content that's protected by the First Amendment. That has never been a constitutional protection. It's never been part of Section 230 immunity. And I think the clear legal answer is that the liability here is obvious. I think the ramifications are going to be really interesting. There is a suite of injunctive relief options that have been floated, discussed. A lot of them go back to things like parental controls, throttling the endless scroll, paring back a lot of the purposely psychologically manipulative aspects of product design. And if not, then just ensuring that you can get sued over that by those who are harmed. And then I think the other side of that is just putting the brakes on outreach to minor users, especially. So age verification for young users, continuing to hold companies accountable, both for allowing minors and then how they treat the data of their minor users on the back end, which does create like a undeniable tension, as India, I think, really spells out very well, is there is this tension between when you age verify, then you do have like data risk issues for sure. But we can learn to walk and chew gum here. You have to have an ID to do a lot of things. You can't walk into a bookstore and buy pornography as a kid It's not a constitutional violation to require that to happen online as well. It's not a violation of the Constitution to require an adult to show an ID in person. We're trying to use the existence of the internet as a platform to circumvent traditional constitutional norms. And anytime that starts to happen, I get a little nervous, but.
Can I just jump in?
All three of us.
I'm going to want to reply to my point too, India.
Sure.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that this could really be huge. Like I'm optimistic. I think that the internal evidence coming out through these trials, which we've never been able to see because no case has been able to reach this stage in the process, they've been getting tossed out because of Section 230. So I mean, I really think that this is the big tobacco moment for big tech in the way that we saw the settlement come out of the litigation against the tobacco companies, stop their harmful practices of advertising and targeting children with their ads, I think is something that I'm hoping will come out of this social media trial, that we will actually see the companies finally held accountable and having to change their business practices. And I do think one of the things that's come up repeatedly in the trial and questioning Mark Zuckerberg and Adam Mosseri is the fact that they have underage users on their platforms, and they're actually not doing anything to effectively age gate even the kind of existing age of 13. There's 8 to 12-year-olds all over Instagram. And so I think that that's another important piece I hope will come out of this, is that the companies will actually be more held more responsible for implementing measures to keep underage users off, and then actually giving more kind of user ability to opt out of certain addictive design features. And the same for parents, because these platforms all advertise parental supervision tools and controls, but they don't actually really allow parents to have real control over what's going on in the platforms. They can't affect the algorithms. They can't turn off infinite scroll or some of these other design features that are meant to continue to draw children back. And so I'm hopeful that it will be a positive outcome. And on that note of kind of age gating, I did want to respond to something that India said. I've spent actually a lot of time trying to study age verification technologies, and I am very positive and optimistic that there are a lot of technologies now that didn't exist even just a few years ago, where a user's age can be verified without revealing any other underlying information about them. So age does not equal identity. We're not talking about compromising people's identities online. I think there are ways that this can be done completely anonymously for adults. And so that really lowers then the kind of First Amendment risks involved in age verification, because I actually think there are technologies like age key, zero knowledge proofs, and it doesn't have to be the platform collecting it. I think India mentioned we don't want these platforms collecting more data. That is not my preferred approach either, but there are actually independent third-party verifiers who are set up to do this well in a privacy-protecting way that I think is the better solution, instead of having the platforms do this. And I'll just mention, just so people kind of understand, what does this look like? One technology called Age Key. You verify your age just once on your device, and you can use your preferred method to do that. And you can pick kind of the verifier you'd like to use. So a lot of user control and freedom in that. And then it actually just stores an age key token on that device that then anytime you're trying to access something age restricted on the internet, whether it be a porn website or maybe a social media platform where these laws are being passed, then you can just say that you would like to allow the site to access the age key on your device. And it's also, you can have multiple age keys on a shared device. So there can be an age key for a parent or adult. And so what happens is, in order to share that age key, you have to, you know, type in your password for your device or scan your face, whatever you use to unlock your device is the same then to say, I want to share my age key. And the only information that is transmitted, again, it's via a secure third party, is just whether or not you are above or below 18. No other information about you at all. And so we're increasingly seeing technological solutions that protect the privacy and anonymity of adults online. And I think that really should change then our calculations about the First Amendment kind of risks or threats of some of these laws. So anyway, that was a lot, but I'm optimistic about the trial. And I also think there are ways we can protect kids effectively and ensure privacy and free speech for adults.
Okay. I have three things. So the easy one first. Spencer talked about showing your ID in the physical space. That is entirely different than showing your ID online. If I go to a bar and I show my ID to the bouncer at the door and the bouncer verifies that I look and like the picture, this is me, I go in. There is no record that I have been at that bar. The bar, I mean, my phone knows, but the bar does not keep a record of me attending that bar, how long I was there, what I drank, what I looked at, who I talked to, all of that other stuff. If you do that online, there's not a way to separate, especially if you're attaching liability to it, there's not a way to separate that digital ID from the actions that happen associated with that digital ID. You're attaching liability to it. They have to keep that record. And that's where you come up with a privacy issue. Second, going into zero knowledge proofs, we also at EFF have a whole lot of technologists. This is obviously a category of things that are very, very important to us. If there, we have some folks that work in the UK. The UK has been doing their whole, forget what it's called, but they've got their liability law associated with age verification and age ID. And so we've looked under the hood of a lot of these different tech companies, and like so many things, whether it's surveillance, whether it's age gate, whether it's zero knowledge proofs, whether it's facial recognition, all of this stuff, it sounds shinier and better than it actually is when you actually take a look at the tech. We have a whole page on our website about digital ID, digital age verification, and all the different claims that the different companies are making about how they can totally do this in a privacy protective way. It's not a problem. And the facts just don't support their claims. They want to sell a product. So their claims are very good. They sound very good. The idea of a zero knowledge proof sounds very good, but there's a couple of glaring problems. And the first one that I just want to flag is that assumes one device per person. And that's not what we're seeing when it comes to children. I mean, especially with younger children. I don't know about the other parents in the audience, but with my little kids, they don't have their own devices. The devices that they use either have my login identification or my husband's login identification on there. So we try to make sure that they only use the devices that we've sort of designated for their use, where we don't put anything on them that we don't want to see. They don't have an Apple ID. They don't have identification. I mean, they have a birth certificate and that's about it. They don't have anything else. So there's no way that they could prove who they are, nor would we want to, because of all of the privacy protections that go along with that. The second thing, or the last thing, is the idea of parental controls and user controls. And we absolutely need more user controls, again, for everybody. There need to be a lot more parental controls, again, for everybody. And there's a huge difference between the government demanding that of companies and consumers demanding that, parents demanding that, nonprofits demanding that. One of the things we would actually really like to see at EFF is Congress taking a look at antitrust laws and making it easier for consumer groups to demand changes of private companies and to be able to vote with their feet to only use products that are willing to support the type of user controls that we would like to be able to see to curate our own internet experience. I mean, we really limit screen time, media time, in our house. Again, we have little kids, and the companies make it really difficult for me to only be able to show my children the things that I have chosen to allow them to see. It's really, really hard to do that. We sort of default to not letting them do anything, but it's hard to let them do some of it. And it's going to get harder as they get older, because I don't have the tools that I would like to have. There's a huge conversation about this in some of the spaces that we're in. And that's one of the things that parents need to be able to do, is to be able to push back on the companies and say, we want more choices for ourselves. We want more choices for our kids. And this doesn't mean necessarily seeing everything that our kids see. That's a huge First Amendment challenge as well. And the other thing related to that is I want to make sure that we're clarifying, that we're clear on what we mean by parents. Who is a parent? Who is a parent in a two-parent household where the biological parents are married to each other and only have one household, one shared everything? What does it mean for parental control, parental regulation in a divorced household? What does it mean with foster care, with adoption, with guardians? What does it mean with extended family? who is allowed to give permission, and how do you expect the platforms to verify the identity of the people and whether or not this adult who is consenting to letting this child do whatever is legally allowed to do that? What does that look like, and how are they supposed to go about doing that? And that's not something that I've seen discussed nearly often enough. How do you define what a parent is? Again, if you just give us all privacy, you can sidestep that issue.
So just one on the last point, that's a great idea. If consumers and parents are able to demand better controls and better products, but that's not happening when they are being constantly lied to by big tech companies who are misrepresenting the nature of their platforms, and then who hide the fact that they were knowingly designing the platforms to psychologically manipulate and take advantage of the consumer base in the first place. I think parents are finally waking up to that, and I'm excited to see how that's going to play out, both in the private litigation side and just on how families treat digital spaces and digital platforms generally. But I also want to go back to this anonymity right that keeps coming up. Like, anonymity is not an absolute right. Like, the argument that age verification destroys anonymity is wildly overbroad. We require identity verification for voting registration, for air travel, for financial accounts, for professional licensing, for any number of constitutionally protected activities that we
don't for air travel. We don't for air travel. You do not have to show identification to fly.
Well, the Constitution protects anonymous speech. It does not guarantee anonymous access to commercial adult services. Modern age verification systems can use things like tokenized third-party verifications or zero-knowledge proofs, which may or may not have technical issues that need to be worked out. But even if those technical issues were worked out, I guarantee that EFF would be here right now saying it's still not worth it. So shifting the conversation to, well, the tech's concerning, or we don't know if that works very well, those are like worthwhile conversations to have. But fundamentally, you do not have a constitutional right to access commercial content. That's just not a right that's ever been protected. And you can confirm identity or adulthood without storing identity data. And that's, as those systems get better and better every day, it's going to be more and more difficult for the tech platforms to hide behind some of these veiled attempts at constitutional arguments. Which also gets back, I think, to the bigger point, which is the real source of liability and what's going to hurt beyond just like age gating is the platform design itself. For a couple of decades now, big tech companies have been misrepresenting their products to consumers and purposely designing them to harm kids because they're making money off of it. That behavior is what we're going to see get knocked down. And honestly, when that issue, now that it's finally being addressed, I think you're going to see a lot of these other issues go by the wayside to some extent. There's a great question on here, I think, on like what should parents do right now for kids. And this is probably a little controversial, but one, don't let your kids access or have access to smartphone devices or social media until they're adults. Two, don't let them have internet access that's not monitored. And three, do this with a group of community and friends and neighbors so your kids aren't isolated and the weird ones for not having a cell phone. Those are sort of the three like practical tips I would give parents. Not that my 7-week-old has a cell phone yet or anything, but those are sort of the practical attempts. But at the end of the day, like when we get to the First Amendment conflict, especially on like the data protection side of things, we're really just down to talking about technical difficulties, like what is technically possible and technically feasible. And with the generation of AI coding and all that we're seeing as this tech advances, a lot of these technical issues I think are going to be gone in a couple of years. And we're going to be left still trying to answer the same question, which is to what extent does the state have a compelling interest to engage in these restrictions on First Amendment issues?
Real fast before the conversation moves on. So, because I wrote this, I typed up an answer in the chat, but I just wanted to make sure for people who are only listening via audio that they would get this too, that I 100% back up everything that Brandon just said. And actually, I wrote a whole book about this that came out in June of last year called The Tech Exit: Practical Guide to Freeing Kids and Teens from Smartphones. And it actually just shows you the practical steps you can take as a parent. And that finding other parents piece is really a key part of what I discuss in this book, like how do you find other families to do this with you? But yes, I just would say when it comes to protecting kids, it is really impossible to effectively lock down a smartphone. And so the best thing that we can all do is just delay that age of first smartphone as long as possible, and then keep children off social media entirely. And then we were talking about internet connected devices. Yeah, like I can't iterate enough that there should be some type of in-person accountability in the home if your child is going online. Just someone else in the room, it being done in a public place, no devices in private spaces or bedrooms, because the risk really is too high. And so there's a lot more practical pieces in the book, but I just recommend that, the tech exit as a resource. So Brandon, thanks for teeing me up on that.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't disagree with quite a lot of those things in terms of what an individual can do. And that's actually the point, is it should be an individual decision based on the actual child that you're looking at and not a blanket one size fits all that somebody at the FTC or the state AG's office decides. Like, that's the thing that we fundamentally have a problem with. Don't outsource your parenting to the government. The other thing is, I mean, we want more controls. We would love to have more controls on all of this stuff. And whether or not EFF changes its mind in the future is going to depend on what is available in the future. We have a lot of engineers on staff. We have a lot of litigators on staff. And the answer to anything is almost always, it depends, because the facts really matter. What does the tech actually do? What is the real world harm? What is the real world scenario of these specific facts with what is actually available? And we really don't like when laws get passed with the assumption that something might exist in the future. Internally, we'll talk about legislators trying to tell tech companies to nerd harder and find a solution to these problems. And like, that's assuming that the tech companies don't want to find a solution to these problems, because I promise you, if there is one commercial organization that would like nothing more than to create anonymously protective, privacy protective age verification, it is the porn industry. They would love to figure that out, because it is absolutely relevant to their business model. And quite frankly, they've done a lot of technological innovations in the past. We wouldn't have DVD and Blu-ray were it not for the porn industry. So
that's wild misunderstanding of the history of those technical platforms. That's a false piece of information that's been floating around for the last 30 years. That is just historically not true at all. But
We have a difference of opinion on that. We're getting close to the end, and I do think I need to give Spence one opportunity here to close us out, and I'm sure the discussion will continue elsewhere.
Sure. Yeah. I just think one high level comment about the political moment that we're in. Everything that's being said about social media in terms of addictive design, harm to kids, it was said about novels. It was said about comic books. It was said about movies. It was said about video games. And at every single point, you run into the First Amendment. And to Brandon's point about not having an absolutist constitutional right to be anonymous in all commercial spaces, I agree with that. But that by definition means that there are some places where you have a right to be anonymous. And I think that's why it's the First Amendment, because boarding a plane isn't necessarily an act of speech. Going into a bar isn't an act of speech. But I think what we've learned from movies, comics, video games is that these are fundamentally speech activities. And while there are real dangers that need to recognize for kids using new technologies, there are also an extreme amount of benefits. So just a high level comment. I think we're in a political moment where we're panicking about a new technology, where if we take a broader view of history and drill down into the constitutional First Amendment interactions with similar media panics, we'll see that, first of all, a lot of it is not constitutional, not compatible with the First Amendment. But second of all, that it just takes time. Maybe it's zero proofs. Maybe it's device level controls. I think society emergently does a better job of coming up with solutions than creating broad federal or state laws that potentially trip us up economically and constitutionally before we're even certain that they are real solutions to the problem.
Well, it looks like it's about time to wrap up. I've been told the most successful moderator is the one who says the least. and promotes the most interesting discussion. So I want to thank my panelists for having what I hope is a very interesting discussion for all of us. And I'm sure the discussion will continue elsewhere.
I will echo those thanks. I really appreciate both our panel and our moderator for joining us today and sharing your expertise and insight. I know we tried to fit a lot into an hour and you did a fabulous job. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.